What is the old new land? Where is the old new land? It's the state of Israel, you schmuck! And seriously, why haven't you bought Israel bonds yet? Because you're a miserable anti-Semite who has no idea how close you put us all to death. Every day, Jews in Israel put themselves in harm's way for your safety, and you've probably invested your bar mitzvah money in the PLO. Maybe you're fine with getting tossed in the sea, but you're dragging the rest of us with you, you miserable Uncle Tomaszewski! And when the Palestinians toss us into the sea, who's going to come up with the technology to let you breathe underwater? Israel! That's who, you self-hating capo! You think your shiksa wife and a loving family will let you assimilate, but we know they're secretly planning to starve you in a pit for months! The Israeli army's been monitoring them for years, and which army do you think is going to come save you from the pit? It won't be the American army, because Israel's the one place we can count on. So why haven't you bought Israel bonds yet? I'll tell you why, because the Nazis don't have shit on you.
A paid advertisement by the American Israel Public Affairs Committee.
All right, let's just queue up the story.
What, you're not going to do the old new land, Bupkis?
No, AIPAC just did it.
They did?
They paid $2,000 extra if I let them use the old new land shtick at the beginning.
They're really paying for that?
Yes, Swamley.
You mean the Rabbi Swamley?
If you want me to call you something respectful, you should give me some respect.
What'd I say?
You implied that the old new land stuff wasn't worth paying for.
Oh, so you're going to disrespect me just because you think I'm implying something.
Well, wasn't that something you were implying?
Well, even if it was, you don't get to disrespect me just because I disrespect you.
I think you just summed up our relationship in a single phrase. Brazilians have carnivale. New Orleans and the French have Mardi Gras. Russians have Shrovetide. Germans have Schmutzige Donnerstag. Sweden has Semla. Lithuania has Ushkavenes. Indians have Holi and Duale. Iranians have Norwuz. Japanese have Higan. Every corner of the world seems to have a vernal equinox festival whose origins predate Purim by hundreds of centuries. Drinking, dancing, dressing, a bacchanal of life to usher in the new spring's regeneration when the noumenal world of no end becomes so full of light and essence that it has to contract some of its enduring majesty into empty space so that, in a divine leap, the shattered phenomenal realm of sense and sensibility may grow again in the hope that some essence of it can yet again leap back to the world of no end. For f**k's sake, don't bring your friends to this.
No, why not?
It just encourages Tata, no? Every weeknight after Mishpacha dinner, they'd talk for a few hours in the cat's basement, as she now spoke in hiding to her secret best friend more than to any friend from school or church. Not a secret for her sake, though occasionally she felt guilty for wishing it so, but certainly a secret for his. Even with the cat's frelick detente, how would his mishpacha react to knowing that Simcha spent every free moment in the almost windowless basement of an halachic shiksa? Meanwhile, Christina had taken up with a 32-year-old junior professor at Berkeley named Dan Krentzman and was rarely seen around the house anymore. He wants to make a scene. He wants the whole city to know we're here, no? But it's going to be fun, no? Who cares? It's just going to end badly for everybody, no? As she did all her friends, Bethany loved Simcha. She just wasn't sure she could stand him. He thought nothing of being negative, indeed seemed to love it, as though making fun of everything she loved was the most generous thing a person in the world could do for his friends, or at least Simcha made it seem like he thought it was. Week one after they started hanging out while Ian Grayling's already flushed and washing his hands, Simcha says loudly, "You shouldn't get mixed up with him, no? He's an Aurora man and a shiker." Week two, Alina and Vicky are in the next room, and he says, "No, don't invite your Yedda friends too often while I'm here. They don't like me, no? And I wouldn't like them if I knew them better." She sees Vicky hesitantly enter the room as he finished the sentence and had to wonder for weeks if Vicky'd heard. Week three, he says outright to Christina, "All Bethany's other friends play at being Corvus, but you're the real thing, no?" The more negative he was, the more need she felt for his approval. No, she couldn't stand him for making her seek his approval. She couldn't stand herself for needing him to support her. And she couldn't stand him again for making her feel the need to be supported by him. Yet even if she didn't like him, she couldn't help loving him, as though there was instant understanding of the rules of a game that was as strange to her as it was familiar to him. There was nothing he said that was wrong, but why did he say it? This utterly new irritation gnawed at her intestines like termites into trees because for her life's first time, she had to confront disapproval from and for someone she loved and clearly loved her back. Around Simcha, from Simcha, because of Simcha, love was suddenly intermingled with dread, pettiness, anger, belittlement, cynicism. Would love, could love, ever feel the same again? By the end of week four, Simchat said nothing particularly embarrassing, but it's Purim, it's Alamo Square Park, it's time to get so drunk you don't know the difference between Haman and Mordechai. All Bethany has to say is the words, free hard liquor, and 90% of San Francisco Friends High School show up, and so will half the adults from the Church of the Holy Fellowship. So will the entire Grayling family, whose brother will make a phone call to the police to ensure nobody's bothered for serving underage liquor. Not that Fat Tuesday is a Quaker or UU holiday, but when Bethany tells Mary that Rabbi Freilich's terrified nobody will show up for Purim, Mary suggests that the Freilichs can turn their Purim party into a combination Purim and Mardi Gras. Bethany tells Simcha. Simcha reluctantly tells Rabbi Freilich, knowing that Tate will jump at it. Ordinarily, Charedim, even Chabadniks, would retch at the idea of an interfaith event. But these are no ordinary times for Chabad. The 92-year-old Rebbe, unable to talk for 2 years, had a stroke while praying at the graveside of the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, his father-in-law, which left him completely paralyzed on his right side. Moshiach should probably do more than be able to sit silently in a wheelchair, but the fact that he lives on with seeming permanence, 1 foot in the world to come and both feet unable to stand, somehow heightens the speculation that Der Rebbe is Moshiach. Nobody's in charge of Chabad, and every rabbi's too busy jockeying for position to oversee themselves. It's a miracle the whole cult of personality doesn't fall apart, and every Lubavitch Shaliach makes his own rules. Rebbe Freilich has big plans for whatever new regime comes when the Rebbe ascends to Olam Haba, and this is the perfect reason to summon allies. If no guests show up for the Purim party, or he's got to explain to them why they traveled across the country for a party so small. No, what they don't know about who shows up can't hide. The Kaddish Baruch Hu always looks out for us, and even if we don't admit it, these Shkotze idol worshippers really do seem like nice people. These are Kohen promised they won't bring meat, and they're even going to bring their own liquor, because all they do is drink. They don't even celebrate the Mardi Gras. No Goyish brachas, no crucifix. It's almost like the Goyim respect us. They're going to pay for the jazz band, for the masks, for the hula hoops, and for the beads. Maybe Hashem really does like these people. Half of the members are married to Jews. No, so even if 102 Goyim show up along with 3 or 4 Jews, we'll tell the Ander Shlichim it's to bring the intermarried ones back to us. What reason to complain, no? Mary brings everything. She even offers to pay for kosher catering, but the Freilichs don't trust any caterers kashrus. She ate before she came to help and insists to the Freilichs that they should have to do as little as possible on their own holiday. They won't let her cook, but she can at least set up the tables and bring out the food. 7 trips from the Freilich house to the table to bring out Rebbetzin Freilich's unbelievable dishes. Hamantaschen, of course, but also phyllo rolls, prune cake, poppy seed roll, falafel salad, something called muchadara, potato pancakes, sorry, latkes, eggplant and chickpea stew, potato and mushroom dumplings, and challah. It's just unbelievable. The Goyim bring their liquor to put aside Mary and Bob's own and place it on a second of the 2 long tables which Bethany and Christina brought out an hour ago with a blue tablecloth which they bedecked with white flower petals to give the decoration an Israeli theme. It's not like the Freilichs don't drink, and before Rabbi Freilich comes outdoors for the Purim celebration, he takes shots of whiskey, vodka, and schnapps, each with Rabbi Weiss, who moved from Crown Heights to Male Adumim in 1978, Rabbi Grossman, who was born in Berlin and now operates Chabad Omaha, Rabbi Schwartzberg from Buenos Aires, Rabbi Kleiner, who's basically lived his whole life in a Montreal yeshiva, and Rabbi Shemtov, who was born in Moscow and now runs Chabad DC. But when they go outside, each of them brings out a different flavored bottle of Manischewitz to put on the table. Nobody over 17 touches it. Mary's eye focuses immediately on one of her more tactless UU congregants, Barbara Rosenstein, who arrives early and carries a brown paper bag from which she takes nothing out. It takes 25 minutes, and she takes out what's clearly a sandwich with meat, possibly even ham. Mary interrupts her conversation to tell Barbara to take it inside. They have such a beautiful spread here. Why don't you eat this instead? But I paid for this sandwich. Just eat it in my house. Come on, just a minute. Let me take another bite, and I'll throw it out. I'm sorry, you have to take it in, but the Freilichs are kosher, and we can't let you eat unkosher meat around their food. Come on, Mary, is it really so terrible to bring food out here? Yes, it is. Now go inside, please. Barbara Rosenstein goes inside directly past Bethany's classmates Dovi Bar-Cherev and Tarek El-Mufti. Rather than finish the sandwich, she puts it back into the fridge and goes directly back out for Hamantaschen and some latkes. Dovi's great-grandfather, David Breinbarg, came to Israel in 1903 after his father was killed in the Kishinev pogrom. David's youngest son, Moshe Bar-Cherev, was an explosive expert who sided with Lehi during their split from Irgun, who became a Technion professor. Moshe's youngest son, Ami, is an anesthesiologist who frequently works with bobcats in spite of the fact that they usually scream at each other in the operating room. Dovi's mother, Maureen, gained 80 pounds since being swept off her feet at California State University by the most confident boy she'd ever met, who even persuaded her to move back with him for grad school in a strange country. Ami now carries on with his Puerto Rican secretary, and Maureen knits crochet for the future grandchildren of her older child and his fiancé. But Tariq's father, a Palestinian Christian named Gabriel, is a third-generation shipping magnate. During the 48 Nakba, Gabriel was in school in Cairo with the other sons of Arab businessmen of distinctions, with future kings, their ministers and diplomats, and even their musicians and movie stars. Tariq's older brother will convert to Islam after getting kicked out of medical school for cheating, while his Jewish friend who gave him the answers was held back a semester. Here in San Francisco, Dovi and Tariq eat the hummus and falafel their mothers make for them. They both listen to the same Middle Eastern musicians like Abdul Halim Hafez and Lydia Kanan, and they catcall the same hippie girls on the same streets. Today as ever, they pick mercilessly on Gennady or Genna Kostovetsky, knocking over Genna's plate of eggplant and chickpea salad so it gets all over his pants and telling him to go over to the Chabad next to pray it off. In 10 years, Genna, by then Henry, will be worth $108 million. His parents work for him and he dates four women at a time, while Dovi is trying to make it as a director in Hollywood while living on his parents' dime. Eventually, Dovi will go into production management. Tariq will be an LSC grad school dropout who organizes protests and lives in an 80-square-meter London flat with seven others. Eventually, he'll sit on the borough council of Tower Hamlet. Around Thanksgiving 1988, Genna's parents come home to San Francisco with sponsorship from distant cousins they'd not been in touch with since the early 1930s, who put them in touch with Jewish charity programs that set them up for jobs as lab technicians. In 1987, Genna's mother, Tatiana, was denied the valedictory prize in her biochemical doctoral program in spite of literally perfect grades. Her advisor, Dr. Nikolaevich, would praise her work to the heavens, but always go out of his way to berate how cheap she was with showing how she did it. So he didn't know how she always got the right answers to all the questions on his tests. And for all I know, you're using witchcraft. All four of Genna's grandparents, from not particularly credulous middle-class families in Vilna and Minsk, were deemed enemies of the people, as they all knew they eventually would be, and mercifully compelled by Stalin's population transfers of 170 million people to relocate in 1941 only as far as Tashkent, capital of Uzbekistan, where their own parents made sure to speak to Genna's parents only in Russian, as did the parents of their Uzbeki, Chinese, Korean, Harbin, Native Polish, Native Ukrainian, Crimean Tatar, Greek, Bulgarian, Armenian, Turkish, Meshkitian Turkish, Kurdish, Hashmani, Karapapak, and Lazesi classmates. But if anti-Semitism was in fact the reason Tatiana was denied her valediction at the USSR Academy of Medical Sciences, that would be quite ironic since both Tatiana and her husband Yosef met each other by becoming devout Orthodox Christians during their first year at Tashkent State Technical University. Tatiana's father died in 1942 at the Battle of Stalingrad, but Yosef's father rebuilt himself as an essential factory inspector for the Tashkent Communist Party and was therefore a militant atheist. The official wedding was scrupulously secular, and a secret second wedding without the knowledge of parents was held in the bell tower of Tashkent's Cathedral of the Assumption of the Virgin. Thereafter, both Yosef and Tatiana, doubtless with help from Yosef's father, were accepted as doctoral students in biochemistry at Bauman Moscow Technical University, where Tatiana was at the top of her class and Yosef somewhere in the top 70%. In 1988, to Yosef's father's devastation, they came over to America with the 10-year-old Genna and settled in the Richmond district with all the other Soviet Jews, where they were not particularly popular on account of adorning their apartment with many icons of the Theotokos and a giant reproduction of Rublev's Old Testament Trinity. They wanted Genna to have a Christian education, but they were horrified at the poor science program at St. John of San Francisco Orthodox Academy and sent Genna to the weak liberal Quakers at San Francisco Friends. Yosef got a job at a laboratory where he was fired for incompetence, perhaps unfairly for a man who didn't speak very good English, and eventually made his living as a cab driver who was not always entirely sober. Tatiana became essential in her lab at Genentech at the University of California, San Francisco, where she was treated as a chief researcher in practice, even if not in name, and was the driving force there behind Herceptin, a breast cancer drug, which was her pet project, the work of 10 years. A thank you to the chain-smoking mother who insisted that Tatiana be the best in all she did. When it came to Genna, they insisted that whatever he did, he too had to finish first. Academically, that's exactly what he was at San Francisco Friends. Socially, not yet. Yet by 2004, when Henry Kostovetsky was a tall and thin tech gazillionaire who dresses all in black with $1,000 leather shoes and a different girlfriend for every day of the week, he's not sure if he ever felt about any of them 1/18th the fervor he felt for Sofia Maggi. At 16, an ectomorphically tall, studious and shy girl whom everybody discovered just last week was Ian Grayling's most unexpected conquest. In 2006, he reconnects with her on social media and marries the suddenly statuesque Sofia in late 2008 after courting her with flowers, weekend trips around the world, and million-dollar donations to charities of her choice. In late 2016, they divorce, and Sofia takes 60% of his money.
Sofia was facing Gena when Noam knocks a plate full of eggplant into his crotch with juice that spills down his leg. Gena tearfully runs into Bethany's first floor bathroom to cry in as much secrecy as he can, humiliated in front of the love of his young life. But it barely registers to Sofia while she's talking to three classmates, but neither Jennifer Hahn nor Farah Tayebi nor Karina Martirosian saw anything of it. Sofia herself could barely stop from crying that whole week, her hookup 5 months earlier with Ian Grayling during a lab partner session being the current subject of everyone's gossip. The teacher's pet of the class might never get her squeaky clean reputation back, forever branded as a slut by her peers at San Francisco Friends, who would be the only people who matter were it not to get back to her father.
Sofia's parents raised her with an aspiration to what they thought to be the perfect American girl. Her parents, Bengali Christians who began life as untouchable Hindus, subject as children to the additional indignity of crossing with their families by foot from what would become the Bangladeshi part of the Ganges-Brahmaputra Delta to its Indian part in the India-Pakistan partition of 1947. Their families only emerged from refugee camps in the mid-50s when evangelical missionaries offered them housing in exchange for conversion. The more Christian the Maggis became, the more opportunities and money Christian organizations gave them. In the 70s, they had enough money to come to San Francisco, where they ran an Indian restaurant and were in the front rows of San Francisco Evangelical Free Church every Sunday. They decorated the restaurant with all the Hindu icons, which they so loathed. They tried to be far more Christian than Indian because, above all, they wanted to be American. In the restaurant, Rajiv and Arundhati always played the same Ravi Shankar record over and over again, but in private, they always played gospel and top 40 radio. Sofia was to get the best possible Christian education, no evangelical school for her, and to be a perfectly learned and perfectly chaste American student with hopefully not a year elapsing before she would become a wife and a mother. Sofia, however, wanted to be a veterinarian and eventually became an obstetrician.
If only Gena knew that if Sofia's thoughts were with Ian Grayling, Karina Martirosian's thoughts were with him. A plain Armenian-American girl of olive complexion, average height and weight, whose parents were always screaming at the top of their lungs. Both of his parents were survivors of the systemic Turkish genocide of 1.5 million Armenians. Her father, on his fourth marriage, was freed by Americans from Treblinka, the place where his mother and sisters were gassed after being forced by Stalin to relocate in 1944 from Armenia to Crimea, where they were captured within a matter of days by Nazis who presumed them to be Jews. With no family left, David Martirosian made his way to America in 1949 after living for 4 years in a West German refugee camp. He was still only 22. Karina's mother came over with her family as a seven-year-old in 1957 from eastern Turkey, Armenian emigres finally fleeing their reluctant country after the Istanbul pogroms of 1955. Her mother, a nurse on her second marriage, was hardly a shrinking violet, and both Martirosian parents would sometimes go to work in long sleeves and sunglasses. For 40 years, David, who had to learn new languages many times in his childhood, was a high school history teacher of great distinction at San Francisco Friends. As a survivor of the world's worst modern genocide and the son of survivors of the second worst. He'd practically spoken to every school, every college, every community organization, maybe even every place of business in the Bay Area about his experiences, and was given every community leadership award San Francisco, Oakland, and especially Berkeley could offer.
Without telling any of their classmates, Karina lived in the Sausalito mansion of Farah Tayebi, her Iranian classmate whose parents would even pay her way through grad school after Mr. Martirosian broke his daughter's college fund to pay his many alimonies. While getting a master's in Middle Eastern history at Cornell, Karina will embrace her until then occasional bisexuality and within 2 months become the life partner of her advisor's TA, Avalon Zimmerman. In 2006, Karina Martirosian and Avalon are married at a barn near Framingham by Avalon's sister, who gets certified by the Universal Life Church. When Gena and Sophia come to Boston, Karina is repulsed that she could have ever been in love with someone so tacky and arrogant. Farah Tayebi's father, Mohammed Tayebi, was a devout Shia Muslim when he was 16 and as an adult became a multimillionaire oil man because his father, Hussein, worked as a chief technician for a British petroleum oil rig and gave lots of information to BP and the CIA about Mohammad Mossadegh's orders when he nationalized Iranian oil. Upon Hussein's death during the 1963 White Revolution, the devout Mohammed was rewarded by the Shah for his father's loyal service with shares in the National Iranian Oil Company, numbering roughly $24 million in today's money, and only increased. Mohammed never worked a day again. The message to avoid mosques was quite clear. By the time the Ayatollah returned, Mohammed was safely in San Francisco, happily married to Ann Brundage, daughter of a Quaker Corner store owner in Orange County, working in 1976 for the Peace Corps in Tehran, when she met Mohammed Tayebi at a relatively expensive Arak bar, 4 months before the Peace Corps was ejected from Iran, whereupon Mohammed sold his shares for a price unknown, giving up liquor and worshipping freely at the Islamic Center of Mill Valley, where his donations added significantly to what already was the largest collection of Islamic books in the United States. Shortly after being Karina Martirosyan's maid of honor, Farah Tayebi will meet a young imam, whom she marries within 3 months of dating. The imam insists she dresses outdoors in a hijab that covers her whole face. Ann Brundage, 21 years old in 1962, working at OMF in Singapore, meets Zhang and Wang Shuhan while on a missionary trip in Taiwan, two 20-year-olds who grew up on subsistence farms in the Gansu province. All four of their parents died in prison during Mao's Great Leap Forward for not meeting grain farming quotas. Their older siblings went missing, their younger siblings starved. They arrived in Taiwan via stowing away at the bottom of a grain ship that left the Tsinghua Bay across the Formosa Strait to Taipei. They work at a small corner shop in Taiwan that reminds Anne of her father's store. She stays in touch with them and writes letters in her not particularly distinguished Mandarin. When Anne marries Mohammed, she gets Mohammed to pay for their immigration, which she sponsors. The Hans operate a fruit market in Chinatown, and Mohammed helps pay tuition for their 8 children to San Francisco friends. When they go to college, the Hans each get in-state tuition at the University of California. Any social life which Jennifer Han has, she keeps a secret from her parents, just like her older siblings instructed her to do. Her parents speak no English except for A and A minus, so she tells them every time she doesn't come home from school around 4 or 5 is because of various extracurricular activities. Extracurriculars at San Francisco Friends have always been a joke. You can form a club that never meets or show up once to yearbook and student government and still be counted as a member that appears as padding on your college resume. What Jennifer's in fact doing is Vihan Chaudhry, Ian Grayling's best friend and the son of Hindu Brahmins, whose Indian tinge to their Oxonian accent makes their immaculate and slightly careful English the most musical sound any Californian ever heard, and who make as much of a point of never speaking to Rajiv and Arundhati Maji at PTA meetings as the Majis make of staying out of their way. Vishnu Chaudhry is a high-power finance lawyer with an office on the 33rd floor of Transamerica Pyramid, who prides himself greatly on the fact that his wife, who is also his third cousin, does not have to work. Vishnu's own father was a barrister born in Kashmir and sat as a judge on the Allahabad High Court. His father before him was a founding representative in the International Congress. His father before him, a textile exporter with contacts all throughout the British Empire. His father before him, a Diwan to the Rana of Uttar Pradesh. Are Jen and Vihan in love? Jennifer might think so. She certainly prefers Vihan's back-of-the-class clown demeanor to Wang Shu's constant pressure at home. Vihan doesn't really care, apparently, about this or anything else. He'll get an 800 on his math SAT and a 510 on his English. After 2 years at UC Santa Cruz, he meets Shannon Horowitz, a communications major who forces him to get serious about his math major. Vihan does his doctorate at Caltech while Shannon works in advertising. He gets headhunted by Bear Stearns and they move to New York, where Vihan and Shannon buy a loft in Prospect Park to raise 2 autistically inclined children. After Bear Stearns goes under in 2008, Vihan and Shannon divorce amicably. Vihan has a 20-year-old girlfriend who's trying to make it as an actress, but he sees Shannon regularly and there's constant speculation by their friends that the two will get back together. But Vihan keeps investing in high-risk, high-yield stuff, so what will Shannon have to come back to? In 2 months, Jennifer will find out that Vihan is also hooking up with her best friend, Kim Young-mi, whose name is actually Young-mi Kim. Young-mi Kim has no need to lie to her parents about where she goes and embellishes her tales of adventures with older boys to Jennifer, who doesn't have the frame of reference to disbelieve her. She goes around every day on her 5'0", 1% body fat self, a different necklace and Prada handbag, with a series of black Barbara Hulaniki skirts and hats. The vast majority of her parents' families live in the utilitarian high-rises of Pyongyang, the free and living ones anyway. Kim's father is somewhere in Asia most of the time. Everybody knows he's in some sort of business. Nobody really knows what. Her mother doesn't work and spends most of her time socializing at the spa. Kim will eventually go into public relations and photography. Nobody really knows if she's making a living from it or living off her father's money, but she has an Instagram account followed by 66,000 people. When she comes up to the table, she touches Simcha on his shoulder, right on his hump, actually, and asks him what those dumplings are called.
Dumplings.
No, what are they really called?
Dim sum.
No, silly. I mean, what do you call them in your language? She pulls a camera out of her purse.
Oh, kreplach.
Can I get a picture?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't take a picture of you.
No, I mean, can we get a picture of the two of us holding up the kreplach?
Oh, he thinks a second too long.
If it's against your religion, you don't have to. You know, let's just take some on the plate to a different side of the park. Kim flags down Bethany to take the picture. Until this moment, Simcha wanted to be anywhere else but here because he was ashamed of wanting to be nowhere else but here. At this moment, he wanted to be nowhere else but here because he was ashamed of ever wanting to be anywhere else but here. Posing with kreplach in this decade before taking selfies became quite so easy. Bethany takes a picture of Kim and Simcha. Kim takes a picture of Simcha and Bethany. And they finally coax Simcha into taking a picture of Kim and Bethany. And then rejoin the Company of Nations. This mini UN stands out among the student body of San Francisco Friends as a smattering of unique loaves in a sea of Wonder Bread. Later, we will meet a few other exotic beneficiaries of these white saviors, and they'll be just as interesting or boring as the others. But when Bethany and Simcha return to their side of Alamo Square Park, Simcha is immediately pulled into the dancing circle by drunken friends of his father alongside 49 other drunken male goyim and thrust into a chair which rabbis and yuppies together lift into the air as though Simcha were the groom at some sort of wedding. The sober Simcha launches through the air and feels drunk as Purim demands. The dread which was his lot banished. The parting sorrows of every night are giving way to new day. Unmeasured realms of ecstatic dreams. Simcha, no longer Chabad, no longer a Jew, no longer Freilich, no longer Simcha. He is unnamed with new perception, new enkindling, ever endless self-knowledge, love's utmost joy warmly glowing from his heart. It's time for Rabbi Freilich to give a speech, not that he's in any state to do so. The Freilichs would like to welcome the Church of the Holy Fellowship and San Francisco Friends School to this Purim celebration.
And Mardi Gras, calls out a congregant.
Whatever,
to the buzz of general laughter.
We would especially like to welcome our neighbors in holiness, the Katzes.
God damn it. Bob has no idea if he said that out loud, but it doesn't matter amid all the applause.
On this very special holiday, we'd like to wish you a happy Purim, a Freilich in Purim. Freilich is Yiddish for joyful, you see? Happiness is our very name.
More general laugh.
And now I'd like to introduce you to Rabbi Weiss, who is doing some of the most valuable work a Jew can do by living in Malei Adumim.
Simcha knows what's coming, and he's powerless to stop it, except to quickly walk back into the house as casually as his panic lets him. He goes into the bathroom, turns on the shower, puts the toilet paper in his ears, and puts a towel over the mirror.
No, once there was a king named Ahasuerus who was not a great king, but he loved to party and he loved the company of women. There aren't any leaders in this country like that, are there?
Everybody knows he means Bill Clinton, and they laugh.
In this country, there was a righteous Jew named Mordechai, much like Bob.
Oh, you, thought Bob while everybody applauded.
And he had a beautiful, virtuous daughter, much like Bob's.
Everybody applauds again.
They're skipping Vashti.
Mary thinks to herself with marvel at their tact. Rabbi Weiss goes on.
But there was a wicked man named Haman. The rabbis all boo and motion for everybody to join in. Boo! Haman was the prime minister of King Ahasuerus's government. And like no prime minister in our day, his decree was law. No matter what he wanted, the world was supposed to go along. And Haman, boo! His ego was so big that he ordered everyone who saw him in the street to bow down to him. But Mordechai, he gestures to Bob, was a righteous Jew, and he would not bow down to Prime Minister Haman. Boo! Boo! Because there is only one God to whom he will ever bow. And nothing like any prime minister today, Haman, boo! This is getting a little excessive, thought Jim Grayling. Developed a terrible hatred of Jews. He hated Jews for being different. He hated Jews for being Jewish. He hated Jews for insisting on their rights. And he hated Jews for thinking that they have a right to a homeland which he thinks belongs to someone else. Motherfucking frumming pieces of shit, Bob! You did this whole thing just for that! Dad, what are you saying? This whole thing, all these Gentiles, all these kids, just so you can spread your fascist propaganda against the peace process. Is that why you moved here too? Bob, stop this right now. That's the whole reason they did this. They want to poison you all and pull the wool over your eyes. Don't you hear what they're saying? Dad, please stop this. You think God gave you the stupid f***ing land of Israel for you to rule like kings and murder anybody who stands in your way, and then you do this filthy little act and make them think you're just the cast a fiddler on the f***ing roof, and what you do is an evil. Dad, please, please. I've seen what you guys do. You sponge off the rest of our people. You breed like rats. And you fill your kids' heads with shit and tell them they don't need to do anything but make more of you so you can vote for more war and screw up the world with more fucking religion.
As Protestants are known for doing, they pretend this isn't happening and they talk amongst themselves.
No, Dr. Katz, really, what did we do that was so terrible? All we did is say that Haman was the prime minister who hated Jews, not like any prime minister today. I know what you really said. That's what we really said. I know what you're really saying. So what are we really saying? That the prime minister who hates Jews is Rabin. That's not what we're really saying, Anu. So what if it is what we're really saying? We got a right, not at a party organized by my wife. This is as much our party as hers. You're sponging off of us just like you sponge off everybody else. We're not sponging. We're fulfilling our holy duties to Hashem, and we thought you wanted to too. I have no holy duty to Hashem. All right, if you don't think so, that's fine. I don't think so. I know so. But it's also not a holy duty to make it seem like you're friendly when what you really want is to keep the war going against Arabs for every inch of Israel at any cost. How can you talk this way to other Jews? I'm not a Jew. So then you're an anti-Semite. There it is. Everybody who disagrees with you is an anti-Semite. That's not what we're saying. How many Jews have to die before you're satisfied with how much land you have? How many Arabs? How many UN workers? We don't want any Jews to die. We want you to live as Jews. I don't want to live as a Jew, and I know what your friendliness is really about. No, someone friendly, what's so wrong with that? So what if we want to show that the people who believe what we believe aren't so terrible? Does that make us monsters?
This disputation goes on for another 20 minutes as they dispute whether Rabbi Weiss was really saying that Bob betrayed his people by marrying Mary. And every minute the crowd gets thinner as everybody says goodbyes to Bethany, Mary, and Rebbetzin Freilich for a lovely party. By the end of this unfortunate kibbutz, the crowd's thinned to nothing. Bob storms into his house, followed by Mary, who's been apologizing profusely all the while Rebbetzin Freilich and Simcha and the rabbis file into their house with their leftovers and children to recite the actual Megillas Esther. Just as Mary and Bob are coming up the steps, Dovi and Tariq are coming down and say an excessively paranoid goodbye, having hotboxed in Dovi's car 2 blocks from the house's front yard with Tariq's weed. After smoking up, they went through the house and made a beeline for the refrigerator. They emerged from the house with 2 Cokes from the fridge and Barbara Rosenstein's sandwich.
So you made this episode 2 weeks late just so you could put in 17 minutes of boring stuff about the characters we're never going to meet again.
I think it was all right.
You think it was all right to make your fans wait another 2 weeks for your stuff just so it can be more boring?
What? You always thought my writing was boring.
But when you made it more than an hour, you didn't tell them it was going to be every week.
What does it matter? Nobody's listening.
It matters because we have debts to pay.
No, Rabbi, I have debts to pay. Debts for which you are entirely responsible.
You don't think you're even slightly responsible?
No, Rabbi, I really, really don't.
What? That's scholar for you, always dodging the responsibility.
Wait, I'm the one who never takes responsibility?
You always think I'm trying to get you.
You literally thought about killing me.
What are you talking about?
We have it on tape.
No, that wasn't serious.
You wanted to kill me and take over this podcast.
Oh, so that's my fault?
You literally just accused me of dodging responsibility.
How can you say that? Whatever you need, Slomley's always been there for you.
Yes, you even follow me around just to make sure of that.
Exactly.
Well, maybe you should try being just a little less responsible.
Aha! There it is!
What?
You don't care about the responsibility, so you think I should be less responsible.
Oh, Gibbalt, that's not what I meant.
You think you can just go anywhere and the world will keep spinning?
Well, according to physics, that's exactly what happens. But do you, of all people, think that's not how you live your life?
Who picked you up from physical therapy that time?
When you picked me up from physical therapy, you made me wait 5 hours while you had sex with my therapist.
And there you go. You're still holding falling in love against me.
Yes, I do. And you made your love for her entirely clear when you first saw her and referred to her as the Yinga Michashefa, or the young witch, in case you don't remember what that means. And then you told me while I was at the lawyer's office that she was crazy.
All right, so maybe the timing wasn't so good.
The timing wasn't so good. I had to crawl into an Uber with a broken f***ing leg.
And that's so terrible.
Oish, Gibbalt. Well, anyway, I think we're getting off the main point here, which is that you literally tried to kill me.
Oh, as though you're not going to try to kill me at some point.
Is this something that happens often to you?
Yeah, everybody eventually tries to kill Swamley. It's just the way people are.
I really can't imagine why that is.
Oh, so it's my fault people are trying to kill me? No wonder I tried to kill you.
Oh, so you admit you're trying to kill me then?
No, I mean, no wonder you think I tried to kill you.
You just admitted you tried to kill me.
I admit you think I tried to kill you.
But you never tried to kill me?
How should I know?
How should you know if you tried to kill me?
Everybody tries to kill Rabbi Swamley eventually. So what if I tried to kill a few of them back?
So you admit you tried to kill me?
I admit I should try to kill a few of them back who tried to kill me.
And who has tried to kill you?
All of my business partners.
All of your business partners?
Yeah, every one of them.
Really?
I don't know why, but eventually they all try to do it.
This didn't come up when we did due diligence about having you as an assistant.
That's because I paid them not to tell you about it.
You paid people not to tell us about your past businesses.
You wouldn't hire me if you knew. Carlop? 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 What are you doing? Why are you looking at me like that? Oh, you give up. Kharlop, stop. Stop. Stop walking towards me like that. Kharlop, get off of me! Ah!
Copyright 2017, AS21 Media, LLC, all rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?